Why don't you get
us going? You want me to start?
Yeah.
Okay. Good morning. Is that coming on now?
No.
Can you hear that? You can hear me. All right, Michael will continue to play with this. We got sound guys to take care of all this noise. I don't know how to run any of that stuff. My name's Rob, and I'm very glad that you're here. The most important thing that you'll need to know is that the bathrooms are right over here. So those of you that have coffee, I didn't notice that no one brought me any. Did they bring you any? No, that's all right. All right. Well, we're glad that you're here. This will be a delightful day together. And if you'd like to stick something in the fridge down in the kitchen, you're more than free to do that. So feel free to just get up, and it's down the hall and at the end, and you'll see where to put all that stuff. I'm going to pray and then turn it over to Selma to start things out this morning. Father, we thank you for the opportunity we have to learn about the history of the world around us, the world in which you've placed us, and we're privileged to know more of your handiwork in all of this, because we know that history is your story, and it is a description of your work of redemption in the lives of men and women. And we thank you for the opportunity that many of us will have to go see some of the sites firsthand that have shaped the world. And we thank you for Selma and Mark and their years of study and hard work to make this all possible for us. Lord, I pray that you would open our minds and our understanding, that this not simply be a time of information, but would be a time for us to be closer to the Savior, that we would know him more thoroughly and perfectly because of our time together. And we thank you for it in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Okay, Michael, did you get this thing figured out? So we got some... All right, we'll continue to work on this, Selma. You just talk firmly there.
Okay, yeah, talk firmly is not really what I do very naturally. I'm going to take one last look at everybody so I can tell who's here, and then I have to take my glasses off so I can read. So I'm getting a look at you. I can even see you back there, Tim. I can see you back there, but not now. Okay. Most of you have a copy of our schedule. I have another 20 or 30 up here. If anybody wants a copy, you just have to come up to the front of the pew and get it, or wave your hand. I have a couple of gorgeous slaves over here. If you waved your hand in the air right now, one of my beautiful slaves will get you one of these yellow pieces of paper. This is my beautiful slave, Elise. Doesn't she have a wonderful personality and sense of humor, besides being lovely? Uh-huh. And now that you have this nice little piece of paper, our schedule says we're having a crash course in Roman history first, and we are not. Well, Greek history has to come first. My secretary, I think, messed up. I must not pay enough. So this got all messed up. So we're doing a crash course in Greek history. And I've had a couple of cups of half-caffeinated coffee. That's as close as I get to real power juice of any type, half-decaffeinated. And with two cups of half-decaffeinated coffee, I'm ready to give you all of Greece history and finish at 10:15 in an hour and 3 minutes. How do you like that? So if you haven't heard anybody speak fast before, you're about to hear it now. Now I have a handout for, this is an outline of all the major points in Greek history. Now wave your hand if you don't have an outline in Greek history. Everyone has one of these? Okay. There went the sound. All right. So let's get started talking about Greece. I've divided this into nice little time periods for you. The Bronze Age, that's the world of Homer. The Dark Ages, the Archaic period, the Classical period, and the Hellenistic period. And after that, you notice that there isn't anything more, because the Romans conquer the Greeks, and then we get into Roman history. And that's why Greek history has to come first. Looking at Greek history and using our outline as best we can, Greek history goes back much farther than Roman history. The Romans don't have anything farther back than 973 BC. That's it. And take a look at our first time period here, the Bronze Age, about 2900 BC to 1000 BC. 1000 BC is the time of Saul, David, and Solomon, and the Israel's Golden Age. And so they go back much, much farther than the Romans. At the time of Saul, David, and Solomon, the Romans haven't even founded Rome. They're several hundred years away from founding their first cities. And that's why we begin with Greek. We've got categories. If you wondered, I had to look this up one time one year. What on earth does the Bronze Age mean, and why did they call that time period bronze? It's because apparently, I read this out of a book, so it must be true. If you add copper and tin, you get bronze. And apparently, it took a while for metallurgy to figure out how to develop bronze and use that for weapons and for tools, and this is called the Bronze Age. That made sense to me. The Middle Bronze Age, because that is a wide period, that's a couple thousand years. The Middle Bronze Age, specifically 2166, is the birth of Abraham. If you are a student and you've been listening to lectures, you hopefully have that memorized. Raise your hand if I had asked you previously, give me the year for the birth of Abraham, you would have known it was 2166 BC. Raise them high. Raise them high. There's parents here. Okay, good job. Good job. We want the parents to know. The later Bronze Age, take a look at that period going from 29 to 1000 BC. The later Bronze Age, say 1446, is the Exodus. Thank you. I knew there'd be. Was that a student, I hope? Oh, good. That's Kurt? Yes. Yes, good job. The conquest, the time of the judges in Israel. And this helps us to understand the Greeks in reference to the Israelites if we realize what these two cultures were doing. The Greeks were descended from Japheth, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's three sons. The Greeks are descended from Japheth. In our Old Testaments, they're called Yavin. It looks like Javan, J-A-V-A-N. Those are the Greeks in our Old Testament. For the line of Japheth, to see how he progresses in his chronology, take a look at Genesis chapter 1, verses 5 through 7. And I won't be looking up verses. You'll have to write that one down. Genesis 1, 5 to 7. The Israelites are descended from who? Shem, Ham, or Japheth? Shem. And that is why the word Semitic refers to Shem's descendants. If you are anti-Semitic, you're anti-Shem. There you go. Now, for the first evidence of European civilization, we look at Crete. Isn't that hard to believe? We look at Crete. Greek mythologist tells us, and we have, do you have those couple of vases with the pretty lady on top of the bull being carried off to sea? We have some vases that have Zeus carrying off a beautiful woman called Europa. And I do have to warn you, this will be the most pathetic use of a projector that you have ever been part of. I'm serious. All right. This is bull leaping. The vases, we have a bull and a woman sitting on the bull, a woman riding the bull. All right, there she is. The bull is Zeus. He apparently, in his form as a god, couldn't get a pretty woman. Imagine that, because his wife killed many of them and chased the rest of them around the world and tormented them, or turned them into cows and things like that. So Zeus turned himself into a bull to try to make himself attractive to this young human, this young mortal. Her name is Europa. We will see this all over Greek art. Europa, riding the bull. And where is he going to take her? He's going to take her to Crete. He says, "Aren't I a beautiful bull? Don't you want to come scratch my ears?" And I suppose she scratches his ears. She climbs on top of the bull. He takes her out into the ocean. And, of course, Crete is an island. He takes her all the way to Crete. Now there's nothing he can do. We will assume he married her, although he's already married. I have to tell you that. But for the sake of any younger children, we'll just assume he married her. And at Crete, they had three sons, Minos, Sarpedon, and Rhadamanthus. Minos became the king of Crete. And that is why that civilization at Knossos on Crete is called the Minoan civilization, from King Minos, the son of Europa, and Zeus disguised as a bull on this particular occasion. When Sir Arthur Evans excavated the palace at Knossos in 1894, because of the association with King Minos, he is the one who named that civilization Minoan, after King Minos. The Minoans were adventurous on the seas. That's probably the origin of the story of the beautiful girl on the back of the bull going out to sea. They were very adventurous on the sea. They traded in the Cycladic Islands. They're called the Cycladic Islands because they are a ring of islands. Pausanias, who was a traveler in very close to the time of Christ, and he went around to famous sites, and he wrote about everywhere that he went. You can get a 5-volume set of Pausanias and read about Pausanias at Corinth, Pausanias at Crete, Pausanias everywhere. And he tells us the story of the land of the Cretans and the association with this bull. Because what's the association with the bull at Crete? What's the bull? The story with the bull, the famous. It involves Theseus. The Minotaur. Yes, who said that? Hannah, yes. I can tell with your hazy face and your voice. I gotcha. All right. The land of the Cretans, this is the island of Crete, is ravaged by a bull. And I'm reading to you from Pausanias and doing the Thelma paraphrase. Apparently, bulls were very frightening in the ancient world during this Bronze Age. For example, many of the old stories involve regular animals who seemed to be a little too big. The Nemean lion was too big. Heracles had to go and kill it, and then he had a special little jacket coat with a hood that looked like a lion's head to wear. Many of these animals got pulled way out of proportion and became stories and mythological stories. Bulls were sacred to the gods, and the Cretans believed that this bull was sent to them as a curse from the gods. The gods are, as we listened in Oedipus Rex very recently, the gods were ticked off, and now somebody has to pay. And so they had angered the gods, and this bull, the Cretan bull, was sent as punishment. Poseidon was mad. In particular, they were not worshiping Poseidon, and he had enough of that. So now we have Theseus going off and killing the Minotaur. Why? Because the Minotaur demanded 7 Athenian youth and 7 Athenian young women to be sacrificed to the Minotaur. You throw them down in the labyrinth designed by Daedalus, and lo and behold, at Crete, Sir Arthur Evans excavated at the palace a multi-room palace complex. Archaeologists will tell you that they get lost in the area of excavation. And we can assume that would be the beginning of the story of the Theseus and the Minotaur and the labyrinth. Probably the palace itself is the beginning of that labyrinth story. Theseus saves the day. He gets to be the king of Athens. His father, Aegeus, was still ruling as king of Athens, but because Theseus went over and killed the Minotaur with the help of his new lady friend with a ball of yarn, a string, or something like that, who helps him not only get down into the labyrinth, through the labyrinth to kill the Minotaur, but helps him get out again with his little ball string? Ariadne. Okay, Ariadne. And he's sailing home. Well, his father, the king, King Aegeus, thought he was sending Theseus off to his death. And as they are waving and parting at the very end, King Aegeus said to his son, Theseus, "By the way, son, I know you're sailing off with black sails because you're going off to doom and gloom. If you should survive and you come back, if you're successful in your quest, be sure and put the white sails up. So when I see the ship coming in, I'll know that you're okay and I won't have a heart attack or something. I'm getting older." Well, Theseus slew the Minotaur on the way home. Oh my goodness, he forgot. He forgot to change the flags out. And he came home under the black flags. His father, King Aegeus, jumped into this sea, and that sea is now called the Aegean Sea. By the way, Europa is the source of our word for Europe. Isn't that interesting? It all goes back to the Greek mythology. So Theseus, oh my goodness, now that his dad has jumped into the Aegean Sea, he's a king of Athens. And so now Theseus is the king of Athens. There we go. About 1450 BC, This is the time of our Exodus. This is the time of the Exodus. If you date the Exodus, you're looking specifically at 1446 BC. In 1450 BC, the island of Thera, near Crete, was ripped into shreds by a massive earthquake. I suppose we would call that a tsunami? Is that how you say that word? A tsunami today? Nearby Crete suffered tidal waves, and most of the civilization was destroyed from this tidal wave and the destruction of that massive earthquake. Crete was invaded. They had a lot of damage done by the tidal wave. It was the time for their enemies to invade them. They were invaded by people from mainland Greece. All we know about these people is that they're very vicious, and they have come to be known by us as the Mycenaeans. This is Agamemnon and Menelaus. These are their people. And you can see we're only at your third bullet point. That's why we call this the crash course. We're only at your third bullet point. These are the Mycenaeans. This is the time, coming to the time of the Trojan War. Agamemnon is the king of?
Mycenae.
His brother Menelaus is the king of?
Sparta,
yes. The Mycenaeans repaired and rebuilt the palace at Knossos, and they became the new inhabitants of the island. They took over. And the Mycenaeans, being a very vicious people, fought amongst themselves. Either that or the Minoans tried to regroup, gather up, and fight against the Mycenaeans. We really don't know. But within another 50 years, that rebuilt palace at Knossos was destroyed again. Destroyed again. The next civilization seems to be a mixture of Minoan and Mycenaean civilization, which makes sense, doesn't it? This survived until about 1184. Isn't that interesting? When the joint culture seems to have collapsed. What's the fall of Troy? The Trojan culture. What's the fall of Troy? The end of the 10-year war. You guys know it. 1184 is the end of the 10-year Trojan War. Troy was destroyed by Mycenaean Greeks. Now imagine, their palace, everything is destroyed, and they have to run away somewhere. And where do they pop up next in history? At Troy, attacking Troy. Isn't that interesting? After a 10-year siege, they destroy everything. The world thought that the story of Troy and the Trojan War was a myth, was not true, was just a story, until the archaeologist, very early archaeologist named, that's a tough one. Anybody know his name? The guy who excavated? Schliemann. Was that you, Hannah? No. Who was that? Aha, Kurt again. Wow, you get all the brownie points. Until Heinrich Schliemann excavated what is now called Hisarlik. At Hisarlik, which is in modern-day Turkey, if you look, we all know where Troy is, right? They've excavated at least 12 layers of civilization, and we're not quite sure which one Troy is. Did the Mycenaean Greeks travel all the way across the Aegean Sea to battle Troy in a 10-year battle? Did that really happen? Well, archaeology has uncovered layer after layer of civilization at Hisarlik, what we call Troy. And it is possible that due to the destruction at Crete, that the Mycenaeans suffered such famine and so many threats from the outside world that they simply moved. And Troy looked pretty good. And so they moved off to Troy. Now, where the account of Helen and Paris running off with Helen, where that story came from, we don't know. But it is a nice excuse to start a war. You've got our woman, the most beautiful woman in the world, and we want her back. Okay. We have a vase painting somewhere there. This is it. This is Paris flirting with Helen, and this is a vase. All of these odd pictures you see are vase or bowl paintings of some type. These are the predominant themes of all of Greek art. Are these stories, the stories that you're hearing, the Minotaur, Theseus slaying the Minotaur, or Paris running off with Helen. We know there are at least three versions of Helen. The one version of Helen and Paris running off to Troy is that he threw her, in some vase paintings, he throws her over his shoulder and takes off with her. In other vase paintings, he is wooing her and she will run off with him. And in the third most obscure version, Helen doesn't really go to Troy, just an image of her goes to Troy, and she's hanging out at Egypt waiting the 10 years out, and then she'll just catch a ride home with her husband Menelaus as he's on his way back to Sparta. All right. Isn't that interesting? Okay. Now the story of the wedding of the sea goddess Thetis. Can you find that one? Thetis? And she had to marry the mortal Peleus. Thetis was a goddess, and since Zeus liked anybody or anything that was female, Zeus was attracted to Thetis. However, there was an obscure prophecy that her son would be mightier than his own father. And that didn't sound so good to Zeus. And Zeus decided, for the welfare of all the rest of the gods at Olympus, we better marry her off to a mortal. When you see the stories of, there's Peleus, he's got her thrown over his shoulder. The goddess does not willingly marry a mortal. And she's forced to marry Peleus. And there you have it. What happens? You have a big wedding, and we're talking gods and goddesses here, all invited except one. Eris, the goddess of discord, was not invited, so she came anyway. Okay. That was not very nice. The travesty of Xenia, when Paris grabbed someone else's wife, when he took Menelaus's wife, Helen, and whether she went willingly or unwillingly, ran off to Troy with her, this breached one of the most important concepts in all of ancient Greece. It's the concept of xenia. The best thing we can call it in English is to call it hospitality. It's a relationship. I give to you, you give to me. You leave my wife alone, I leave your wife alone. You touch my wife, I kill your wife. That's the Greek concept of xenia. We'll see that word change in usage and in another session this afternoon when we're talking about world views in conflict. We'll touch on xenia and how that concept changed from the time of Homer, 1200 BC, to the time of Socrates and the philosophers, 400 BC. And then xenia, as the Apostle Paul used that word in the New Testament. And it's a completely different usage of that word. It's really exciting. So the Trojan prince steals Helen from the Spartan king Menelaus. Now, all the Greek kings, how many ships are going to sail for Troy? 1,000. And why do they sail? Helen has the face that launched 1,000 ships. Only if you have seen Greek fashions, you know it was not her face that launched those ships. So, there's no wind. This is 1200 BC. We have to have wind to get to Troy. What if we don't have any wind? How could we get wind? We'll ask the gods and the goddesses. Uh-oh. Who's in charge that day of the wind?
Artemis.
What does Artemis want in exchange for fair sailing winds? A sacrifice of who? Iphigenia, the oldest daughter of King Agamemnon of Mycenae, the greatest of the Greek kings who sailed to Troy. And so Agamemnon, like a good king leader, sends word home to his wife at home, Clytemnestra, and says, "Would send Iphigenia out to the seashore here. Achilles wants to get married before we leave." And Clytemnestra thinks, "Oh, isn't that cute? That's so romantic. I didn't even know. I never even noticed. There must have been the little looks there, but I didn't notice." And so here goes Iphigenia down to the seashore singing. Okay, I can do it. "I'm getting married in the morning." Right? And she gets down to the seashore with her bridal array and probably her maids of honor, and surprise, she's not coming to a wedding. She's coming, and her father will sacrifice her in exchange for fair winds to sail to Troy. Now, if you like the cleaner version of the story, as he raises the knife and slays his oldest daughter, the goddess Artemis whisks away the real girl, puts a deer there that kind of looks like a girl, and everyone thinks that Agamemnon has sacrificed his oldest daughter, but really she has been whisked away and Iphigenia has been taken to the temple of Artemis at Taurus. And you can read that in a Greek tragedy. Most of us just read it this last week, or you're reading it this week, right?
Okay, reading it this week. Good job. You just finished it? Okay, good job. It's the only tragedy that's not completely tragic. Yeah, it has a little bit of a good ending, doesn't it? So, now, one of the Trojan king Priam's son. How many sons does Priam have? 50? Priam, King Priam of Troy has 50 sons. One of his sons, one of his younger sons, is named Aeneas. He's named Aeneas. And Aeneas escapes Troy. He's going to escape Troy, and he's going to make it all the way to Italy because Troy has been destroyed. We need to build a new Reich, a new major city. This is the Second Reich. Troy was the first, and Rome will be the second. And, of course, we all know during World War II, Hitler was attempting to build the Third Reich. Aeneas escapes. He makes it to Rome. He has a little stop on the northern coast of Africa at Carthage and has a little fling with a woman, the queen of Carthage, with Dido there. And then the gods send down a messenger god. Who's the messenger god who has to go give the messages? Hermes. So he sends Hermes down to Carthage to say, Aeneas, remember what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to be heading north up to Italy to found a new place for all the displaced Trojans. And so he leaves. We'll be reading that story in the next couple of months. This brings us to the Dark Ages. We finally progressed in your outline to the Dark Ages. This takes us to the Dark Ages, and this is our next major historical division. The decline of Greece coincides with the founding of Rome pretty well. If the founding of Rome is 973, the decline of Greece, we're going into the Dark Ages, right in the middle of the Dark Ages, is the birth of Rome. This also corresponds roughly to the time of the United Monarchy, or the Golden Age, in Israel's history. Remember? King David, King Solomon, Solomon building the first temple in Jerusalem in the 960s BC. Remember, he spent 7 years building the temple and then 14 years building his own house. The Mycenaeans did not build temples, but there did seem to be altars and rooms set aside for venerating gods in Mycenaean excavations. As the Mycenaeans abandoned Greece during this time, and this is very interesting, they may have fled not only to Egypt, to the island of Cyprus, but also to Italy. These are Mycenaean Greeks going to Italy just about the time Rome is founded in Italy. There are very strong connections that to tell us that the first Romans may have really been the leftover Dark Age Greeks. Those Etruscan Romans may have had Greek heritage. It's very interesting. But the Romans never take their history back farther than 973. Maybe if you take their history back farther than 973 BC, you get to the Greeks. And so they begin their history at 973. It's interesting, and we really don't know. It's very interesting. We'll talk about the Etruscans in our second crash course. The next historical records bear witness to the Dorians, a culture that may have risen from the Mycenaeans. These connections are hard to make because there are no written records. All you have are pots to look at. If the pot in Egypt looks the same as the pot on Crete, then you know that there was some type of trade or commerce, some type of something going on together, but we don't know what. Very little is known about this Dark Ages, the Dark Ages of Greece, and that's why it has the name the Dark Ages, because we don't know much about it. So we say, well, you know, it must, maybe not too much went on during that time, since we don't know about it. Several waves of immigrants left Greece, and they started colonies independent from Greece. They may have been, the Greeks may be the only culture in the history of man who knew how to write and then forgot how to write. They may be the only people, yeah, who knew how to write and forgot how to write. Isn't that amazing? Can you imagine? And now I told my friend, Pastor Steve Rouse and Pastor Rob Martini, if you know something about anything we're talking about and you have something to say, you're supposed to just stand up and jump up here and share it with us. Okay, don't hold the smarts. Share the smarts. Okay. That's my motto, right? About 750 BC, writing appears just in time, and it's just in time to preserve the national epics of Homer, the Greek national epics of Homer, which are, what are the two epics? Yeah, boy, are you tired of those words, aren't you? Yeah, I can feel it. I can feel it. We won't say that again here. All right. Now, at the same time, think about this. 750, the Greeks are relearning how to write. What's going on in the rest of the world about 750? What amazing, awful event will happen in Israel in 722 BC?
Assyrians.
The Assyrians. And what will those nice, friendly, dressed in red to scare you to death to look like blood Assyrians do? Yes, they go down and they take over the northern kingdom, and the Assyrians are those who scatter. And the northern kingdom, those 10 tribes now become the 10 lost tribes of Israel, and they are scattered. The Assyrians plant people in northern Israel. That area will become Samaria, and those people will be hated. The Jews, the good Jews, during the time of Christ will not even walk through Samaria. On their way to Galilee, they will cross the Jordan River, walk up on the other side, cross the river again to get to Galilee, because those Samaritans have Assyrian blood. They are the world's most dreaded enemy. Egyptian culture had deteriorated after the Exodus, 1446. We know that historically now. Egyptian culture, what happens when you lose your slave workforce? When Moses takes them all away. And many historians have still not put those two facts together to realize that that is why Egypt went into decline, because they lost their slave labor. I think these things are fascinating. But the Greeks still had a constant trade going on with Egypt for linen, for papyrus, it's nice to write on, wine, perfumes. Whoever those Etruscans were, who might be Greeks that the Romans claim to be Romans, the earlier immigrant Greeks or the native Italians, they came into conflict with those Greeks that were trying to settle in southern Italy. This means we might have the people of Yavin in the Old Testament, the Greeks, we just have a different brand of Greek fighting another different brand of Greek. The world and history gets smaller and smaller the more you study history. And I wish I could make the connections of the written word for you. People are still giving the Phoenicians credit for introducing the alphabet, but there are many people, including some of the Hebrew and the Ugaritic professor at Corbin College in Salem, who are making connections with the Hebrews rather than giving the Phoenicians credit. It's very interesting. We know so little. We know so little. Are you confused yet? Are you just staying with me? Okay, because I'm part confused half the time. All right, now, about 474 BC, so I'm jumping up almost to archaic here, the Greeks defeated the Etruscans, and the Etruscans might be Greeks. They might be Greeks. In a sea battle, and I'm telling you about this one because of where it took place, off of Cuma. C-U-M-A-E, off of Cuma, which is just, it's very close to the Bay of Naples and the city of Naples in Italy. There is a trapezoidal-shaped cave that goes underground for hundreds of feet. It's the site of the Cumaean Sibyl, the Cumaean Sibyl that Michelangelo painted on the Sistine Chapel. You have to ask me that one during lunch. It's too long of a story. But she's there on the Sistine Chapel, the Cumaean Sibyl from Cumae. And in this battle, the Greeks defeated the Etruscans off the in the sea at a battle off of Cumae, and the Etruscans then lost their control of the northwest Mediterranean. Now, the most successful people in the Mediterranean world, I'd draw the map for you, or I'd put it up, except my map is much better that I draw on the whiteboard. It's a little more precise. The most successful people during this time were the Phoenicians. This is that little strip of land that's 120 miles by 5 miles on the eastern Mediterranean. They got all of the ocean property, right? They got all the ocean property. They live on the coast. They lived on the coast of what we now call Lebanon. The Greeks called them the Phoenicians. And that is where we get the word Phoenician, or the purple men, because of the purple dye they produced from that odd little seashell that had the purple dye, and you had to have thousands of them to dye anything purple, and that is why purple became the royal color. It took so much work, so much effort, so much time to produce a purple dye. Only royal people had purple dye. And so your clue in literature, in ancient literature, if you are reading about the Iliad or the Odyssey and someone is wearing purple or has a basket of purple yarn, you're supposed to be very impressed. Very impressed if they have anything purple. The Phoenicians are known for exporting purple cloth, for exporting timber, for exporting glass, goods made of metal and wood. During this time in the world, glass was more valuable than gems. It was very difficult to make. Glass was more valuable than gems. Isn't that interesting? And they did the fine inlaid furniture. These Phoenicians, what do we call them in the Old Testament? The Canaanites. Isn't that interesting? About 1000 BC, when the Hebrews, okay, the Israelites, they're already living by wisdom literature. Think about it. 1000 BC, David and Solomon, the Proverbs, Ecclesiastes are still being written, but they're almost finished. Job and Genesis, the Pentateuch is way, way back because Abraham's 2166, and we don't know what written records there were. All we have access is to what Moses put together for us, which would be about 1500 BC. But certainly there may have been earlier written records. God's people have always been a people of written records and a people of writing, careful recording. The Hebrews, 1000 BC, they're finishing up their wisdom literature. And what do the kings have to do? Every Israel king? They have to make their own copy of the law. Remember, they have to make their own copy of the law. So the kings, the Israelite kings, are already making their own copies of the law. And the Phoenicians have just invented the alphabet a couple hundred years ago. Now, I don't think that that's very accurate. That's what our history books tell us about the Phoenicians. But I believe that connection between Hebrew and the written word will become more and more clear as we do more excavations. It's fascinating how the Phoenician alphabet, the idea of the Phoenicians developing the alphabet, how that's crumbling away a little piece at a time. Very interesting. Most of the Greek alphabet we can easily decipher because it looks just like English. And that's why we'll do about 25 or 30 minutes of some Greek, really crash course Greek, and teach you how to sing Jesus Loves Me in Greek. And that way you can leave here today and at least not be afraid of looking at Greek resources. Isn't that interesting? What did the Greeks do? What did their cities look like? Let's think about that. Every Greek city had an agora. Every Greek city was an independent city-state. Very similar to the U.S. Every state wanted to remain independent but be part of the union. Each Greek city-state was independent but part of the union. Each city had each city was a polis. Poli is the plural of polis, a city. Each city would have protective walls. They had a central agora, the agora. The Romans would call this area, we would call it Pioneer Courthouse Square. The Romans call it the Roman Forum. The Greeks call it the Greek agora. And they would have a fortified place on the highest spot in the city. And you would call that the high place of the city, the Acro Corinth, or the Acro Athens, the Acropolis. Each city would have an Acropolis, and you would put all your important buildings there, temples you didn't want invaders or marauders stealing, temple treasures and things, and so all the temples end up on the high places. The largest of these Greek city-states was Athens. Greek society, how did they build all those beautiful buildings? How did they develop their philosophy and the ideas of democracy? My goodness, they must have had a lot of free time to think of all those things. And I heard somebody say it here. Slaves. The Athenians depended on slaves. There were more slaves in ancient Athens than there were citizens. And of course, citizens are only males. Women are pretty much locked at home. Those Spartan women had it, I don't know if we'd say had it good, because They were out there exercising and competing with the men and had pretty rough lives. If your husband didn't want the baby, you just left it out for exposure. If your baby had a defect of any kind, you left it out for exposure. The Athenian women were treated to the opposite extreme, which means they were pretty much locked at home because nobody trusted them. So an Athenian young woman, once she got married, might not ever see her mother again, except at weddings and funerals. Unless she was very, very poor and didn't have her own slaves to send to the market and places like that, she would live at home. And so during this period, who are the only people on the face of the earth? Who are the only, I love this one, I guess because I'm a woman. Who are the only women on the face of the earth during this time who enjoy a protected, privileged status? The Hebrew women. Isn't that ironic that our culture today tries to tell us that Christianity and Judaism oppresses women, and the reality is that those Hebrew women were protected and cared for and had extremely special status. Our Bible is filled with the narratives of very important women. You don't have an important man without an important woman right there in the Old Testament. I think that's fascinating. If you were a Spartan woman and had a baby, you were expected to be up and about that same day getting your work done. If you were an Athenian woman having a baby, your mother would be allowed to come over and deliver the baby and you'd be at home and on your own. If you were a Hebrew young woman who had a baby, you'd be unclean. Oh no. Oh, you can't go to temple. Oh, you can't cook. You can't touch anything. You're unclean. Your neighbors have to come in and cook for you and do all of your work because you're unclean. Isn't that incredible? Don't you see the irony of that? I love that. That's one of the most fun things I ever learned at seminary. Okay, I guess because I'm a girl. All right, now we come to the time of the aristocratic rule. They're called aristocrats because they are the aristoi, which means, guess what aristocrat means? Does anybody know? It is terrible. We still use that word today.
It's like the higher class.
The best people.
Yeah, like the aristocrats. They were like cats, but they were in the society.
And what was that?
The aristocrats?
Yeah. Oh, Disney movie. Oh, it must have been a girly pink one. Okay, we had boys and we only saw the boy blue ones. Okay. Wow, you had me there. You had me there. I wanted to learn about it. I thought, oh my goodness, I never heard that. The aristocratic, okay, there we go, rule. The rule by the few was known as the oligarchy. If a man opposed the rule of the oligarchy, those best people, then he could, how would you vote? No, you'd raise up enough men and you'd go and overthrow the other oligarchy, and you would take over the polis. These tyrants would, as they became known later in history, that's a good word, tyrants, sometimes ruled for lengthy periods, but most of the time they were very quickly deposed. So we don't have tyrant lists because you never know. You can't watch your back often enough and they change so often. The Greeks specifically at Athens began to develop some very unique ideas that no one else had thought of. Now I personally believe that it is because we're within 400 years of the birth of Christ. And I'm not a loony. My seminary professors told me that rings true. 400 years before Christ, it is time to get things on the earth prepared for the birth of God with us, Emmanuel. 400 years before Christ, we got to get the Greek language together and all over the known world, right? Do you want those apostles in that first century AD to have to translate Paul's letters every time they go 30 miles? No, we need the entire ancient world to be speaking the same language so that the New Testament can be written in a very simple, beautiful, expressive language, beautiful, theological, expressive language. English doesn't come anywhere near close to Greek for theological studies. But we need people to speak Greek. So what's going to happen? Things start happening in Athens. They decide they're going to have a council. They're not going to be ruled by oligarchies. And this council is going to meet on Mars Hill, the hill of Ares, the god of war. And they're going to have trials on Mars Hill, on the Areopagus. They're going to have trials there that are religious trials or trials for murder. That's what they'll do. They will have a trial and they will vote and they'll decide. And so if someone murders someone else, they will have a trial. Was it accidental? We might actually let them off. If it was on purpose, we'll put them down in the prison and tell them, here's your glass of hemlock. Have a drink. Now, they begin to carry out policies by the use of archons. Lit Circle students just learned about archons in their studies of Socrates and the two dialogues we read. These are aristocratic government officials. The tyrant is gone. The Athenians at first chose Draco. This is about 630 BC. This is the origin. Draco is the origin of our adjective draconian, which means too strict, better let up a little bit. He was too severe. Then the next aristocratic archon is Solon. Solon introduced all types of reforms in 594, and he became very popular. He forgave some people their debts. He said, you owe some people some money, but we need to get the economy going, so you don't owe them that money anymore. Solon was instantly popular. Imagine that. Now, for a short while, even lower class citizens could hold government offices, and poverty and debts were reduced. These are ideas that the rest of the ancient world has never thought of. The rest of the world has not thought of these things. But we're going to need these things. In fact, the Americans will need these things in the 1700s AD, right? And so these things have to develop so the Americans can get their ideas from somewhere. The reforms didn't always make the aristocratic elites happy. For example, if you forgave debts and you were the person that everybody owed debts to. And Solon had to run away from Athens for a while. Then Pisistratus, try to say that word, became a tyrant in 546. So we have this battle going back. And Athens enjoyed a time of peace and prosperity, believe it or not, with this tyrant. His son Hippias, there's a nice Greek name, Hippias, became a tyrant after him and ruled until 510. We're building up. When the aristocrat Cleisthenes, who's very important, usurped the last tyrant, he introduced a new form of government. And this new form of government, they thought, what shall we call this new form of government? Let's see. It's a kratos. We're a demos. We have these different demes. Athens had 10 different demes, little areas of little voting areas where everybody was related. What do we call that today? Our little voting precinct. Right, precinct. Thank you. So it would be like a precinct. These demes, he decided, you know what? We rule through these demes, and the people are the ones doing the rule. Kratos, demos. Demos, kratos, democracy. Let's call it democracy. It'll be the rule of the people. All the people of the demes will come and vote. Now, it's not representative voting. They all have to show up. In Sparta, which is not like Athens, remember those Spartan women? One of the largest of the Greek city-states, life was harsh in Sparta. It's the biggest of the Greek city-states on the Peloponnese. The Peloponnese is that point, if you've had the privilege of being witness to one of my beautiful Mediterranean world maps, you know that the Peloponnese dangles off of mainland Greece somewhat like a cow udder ready to fall off. You could say a hand, but a wrist is too thick, ready to fall off. And this is the Peloponnese. Well, Sparta was on the Peloponnese, and Sparta did not like it that Athens was becoming more and more popular. In fact, Sparta and Athens really had very little in common except that they were all Greeks, and they never did like one another very well. Physical training was very important in Sparta. As soon as you were 7 years old, if you made it to seven, then you were sent off to the men's barracks to live, taken away from the influence of your womanly mother. If you had any defect, you were left out and exposed to die because the Spartans did not want any defective Spartans. They're encouraged to get resourceful. What kind of things do you learn in the barrack when you're 7 years old? Well, they take away your shoes, they take away your blanket, and they make you fend for yourself. And you learn how to steal, you learn how to connive, you learn all of those skills that the Spartans value so highly. After marriage, at age 30 or so, a Spartan would remain quartered in the barracks because only wussy men live with their wives. You marry your woman, you remain living in the barracks, and when you want to go see your wife, you better sneak off, because if the guys see you, you are not going to look very manly, especially if you have a bouquet or a box of candy or something like that. You're a history. The Spartans made a league of Greek city-states. Okay, they all joined together, and they called them the Peloponnesian League. So guess where those city-states were all from? The Peloponnese. So they all grouped together in a league, and they called themselves, it was very original, the Peloponnesian League. Now, they're going to offer assistance to one another in time of great military need. Just in case some big world power attacks us, we need to have this league. We'll defend you if you would defend us. And, of course, the Athenians did the same thing. Now we're entering the classical time period, and this is, we're finally down to the fourth area. I did not mention the Olympic Games of 776 because it's crash course. You have to take a look at that for yourself. There we go. I got out of that one, didn't I? The classical time period. Now we are coming to the time period that your children have been studying more thoroughly. And this is the most interesting to us as travelers if you ever get to go and travel in Europe, or to understand the slides. This is the most important area of history. Now, the Persians, the people now we call the Iranians and the Iraqis, those are the Persians, they were expanding their empire in the 6th century BC. That means the 500s BC, expanding and beginning to crowd on to the Greeks. Now, the Greeks found themselves on the defense all the time. They're getting crowded out by the Persians, who like big kingdoms. The Persians do not have little independent city-states, right? The Persians have a massive empire that they would like to expand. When the Persian king Darius attacked Marathon at the plain of Marathon, the Battle of Marathon, which is, how long is a marathon? 26.4 miles? Marathon is 26.4 miles from Athens. The Battle of Marathon, Darius attacked Greece in 490 BC, and he was repulsed by less than 10,000 Greeks. And he had brought, I don't know how many dozens of thousands, I only wrote down my 10,000 Greeks. The Persians didn't go anywhere with a small little wussy army of 10,000. Now, Darius didn't do so well. So what do? Your son becomes king. 10 years later, 480 BC now, we have Darius' son Xerxes. Xerxes is, in many of your Bibles, is the Ahasuerus. Xerxes is the wonderful Persian, must have been just a wonderful person, that Esther was so fortunate to marry. He goes off to Greece to do what his father could not do. Dad couldn't get them at Marathon, those little puny Greek city-states, this huge Persian empire. And so Xerxes goes off in 480, and at Thermopylae, what happened there? They recently made that new movie called 300. Those are the 300 Spartans who held off the Persians. I wouldn't advise watching the movie. If you watch it through your clear play machine, so it takes out all the bad, violent things, it's like 11 minutes long. So you could look at the box. If your family lets you go in the video store, I'm not allowed to go in the video store. Actually, I get worked up just thinking about it. I'm not allowed to go in the video store, but if you are allowed to go in the video store, you could look at the box, and it would kind of give you an idea. You're going to have to skip that one. These 300 Spartans knew they would die, and they were willing to sacrifice their lives, and they were all buried there at the pass. And the last thing that it is known that they did the night before the Persians wasted them all was to rebrush their hair and rebraid it so they would look pretty smart in the morning. Those were the Spartans. Now, they marched on to Athens. The Persians march on to Athens, and they're feeling pretty good. They just killed off all those Spartans, right? With the help of a traitor, if you know your history. They go into Athens, and they do burn the city to the ground. All the Athenians are in boats, right? At Salamis. But the Greeks beat the Persians again, and Xerxes has to go home defeated by the Greeks. But he did at least get to burn the city down. And he did get to burn everything up on the Acropolis, the high place. He got to burn that all down. And that was actually rather convenient for the Athenians because they did so well in battling against the Persians, they earned the respect of the rest of the Greek city-states. And they said, you know what? We should form a league, and our league should probably have a treasury where maybe we would all donate some money, and we'll hold it. We'll build a special treasury to hold the money, and then we can build a sea, a fleet of ships or something, in case the Persians come back. You never know when they could come back. We'll take care of the money. And lo and behold, the burnt city of Athens and the burnt Acropolis, up sprung gorgeous buildings. All the things you see in the pictures now, those were all built thanks to Xerxes burning everything down and thanks to the Athens earning the respect of the other city-states and becoming the holder of the treasury. I realize that it goes against all principles for a government official to use money unwisely or money that was not set aside for that purpose, but yes, it happened. It happened in history. It could happen again. They form their league, and it's not called the Peloponnesian League. They call it the Delian League. And they're going to share resources and share money. Now, the Greeks didn't trust the Persians, but the Persians went into decline, as all world empires do. Your children have been studying the empire of the Assyrians, and when the Assyrians could hold on no longer, we had the empire of the Babylonians. And then we needed Cyrus to come back so that those Babylonians would let the inhabitants of Jerusalem go back 70 years later, right? And so we had the Persian Empire rise up, and the Persian ruler, Cyrus, allowed the Israelites to go back home to Jerusalem and even gave them some of the temple treasures back and helped them get there safely and said, go ahead and rebuild your walls. Isaiah, remember, had prophesied about that, Isaiah 45, something like that, that my servant Cyrus, 140 years before Cyrus was born. So now the Persians are going into decline, just as the Assyrians did, just as the Babylonians did. Now the Persians are going into decline. We're getting closer and closer to the time of Christ. The Persians have to go into decline because our New Testament is not written in Farsi. It's not written in a Persian script. It's written in Greece. The most famous politician of this period was Pericles. It just so happens that Pericles' friend Phidias was a good sculptor, a famous sculptor, and in need of a little work. And Phidias designed all those things you see on the Parthenon, most of those beautiful statues. Either he or his students carved those and designed those. That is who was in charge of the Acropolis like we see it now. Now, Sparta doesn't exactly like it that Athens is glowing and gorgeous and beautiful. This has been brewing for centuries. Sparta does not like it. And pretty soon, the Peloponnesian League and the Delian League are having severe problems. And that leads to our civil war. This is the Peloponnesian War, your third bullet point under the classical period. This is the civil war between Athens and Sparta. And this is a 27-year war from 431 to 404. Much damage. 27 years war. Plague broke out in Athens. They built big walls. They couldn't get away from the plague. They had to stay there. Many died off. Pericles died. The Spartans built a fleet. They defeated the Athenians at sea. The Spartans broke down all the walls. The Delian League was ended. And Sparta installed an oligarchy in Athens, people who they thought would be favorable, Athenians who would be favorable to the Spartans. And at this point, these 30 people that the Spartans set as an oligarchy over Athens when they defeated them in 404 BC become known as the 30 tyrants. And unfortunately for Socrates, who you know drank the hemlock in 399, 5 years later, unfortunately for Socrates, his best pupil, Plato, happened to be related to one of the 30 tyrants, and Socrates was known to be associated with him. And your students know that that is the most probable reason for Socrates being forced to drink the hemlock. Instead of war hero status that he had earned, the war hero status he had earned during the Peloponnesian Wars, he was now called a traitor. And he was so upset at being called a traitor for the city he defended and loved that he said, no, if Athens... His friends tried to help him escape, right? And he said, no, if Athens wants me dead, then I will drink the hemlock. So be it. The rise of Macedon now. And the Hellenic lead. The Macedonians. This is Philip of Macedon. We're looking at that area north of Greece. And then his son, Alexander, who goes down in history as Alexander the Great. Unless you're Greek, the Greeks didn't think he was so great because Alexander the Great comes down and conquers Greece, but we call him Alexander the Great. The Macedonians thought they were descended from Zeus. Many cultures thought they were descended from Zeus. The Greeks thought they were uncivilized barbarians. Under Philip of Macedon, who only had one eye and he had a short leg, apparently he spent a lot of time on the battlefield, the country was turned into the greatest power of the Mediterranean world, Macedon. Philip was brilliant. He was charming. He was a great speaker. And he wanted to expand his empire. In 342, there were not very many Greek city-states left. They organized together to try to battle this new force, and they called themselves the Hellenic League to try to save themselves. But by 337, they were swallowed up by Philip of Macedon. And he dies in 336, a year later. He had joined the Greek states together and called the League of Corinth. Now, under Macedonian rule, they decided to attack, now that they were bigger, right? They were part of Macedon also. They had decided to attack their old enemy, Persia. One of Philip's wives, the only queen, gave birth to a young boy, to a baby boy, Alexander. Alexander became the heir when his father was assassinated mysteriously and had married another woman who had had another baby who all disappeared mysteriously. Kind of interesting how people disappear mysteriously. The tomb of Philip was dug up in 1977. They know it's Philip because the greaves, the shin guards for the ankles, are of different lengths. It's a royal tomb from the right time period, and a royal casket, and his eye cover thing is there. What do you call that? Eye patch thing, but it's like a bronze or gold or something. He only had one eye. I don't know if he was born with one or if it got, you know, pooped out. One of the evidences of the tomb were the uneven greaves. We always said that. Okay, he was lame. Now, we're to the time of Socrates, Plato. Socrates taught Plato. Socrates didn't write anything down. His student Plato wrote everything down. Plato said, Socrates says this, and then Socrates said that. No one can put Plato in jail and call him a traitor because he's only quoting Socrates. These are not my own words. I'm just quoting Socrates, who was great and who I don't want to be forgotten. Wow. It fell out. Okay. Maybe I leaned on it. Let's try. Oh, that's really nice. Closer to the eyes. The old eyes. The eyes like it. All right. Socrates had taught Plato. Who was Plato's student? Aristotle. And Aristotle was the tutor of? Alexander the Great. So guess what? Guess which little boy grew up loving all things Greek? Alexander the Great. He loved all things Greek. Alexander, not only did he love all things Greek, he conquered all things Greek. He loved Greek anything. It is said that he slept with a copy of the Iliad under his pillow. He went to Troy during his life so that he could do what all mighty Greek warriors do. Run around the grave of Achilles in the nude. And he liked Greek so well. He said, I think I'll found a lot of cities with multiple libraries. We'll call this one Alexandria. We'll call the one over here Alexandria. And we'll call that one Alexandria. And this one Alexandria. And we'll build libraries. And anything that is worth anything, we're going to translate into Greek, my favorite language. And before you know it, before Alexander dies in 323, the entire known Mediterranean world knows how to speak Greek. They have their native tongue, but they all speak Greek. They trade in Greek. They do business in Greek. They correspond in Greek. Now, Alexander dies 323. Oh my goodness, we've got the whole world to divide up, and who's going to take it? His wife, who was expecting, had her baby, and about the time her little boy would have been old enough to have any claim, mysteriously disappeared. Roxanne mysteriously disappeared, and her child mysteriously disappeared. What do you do when one man has ruled the world? Well, he's got four generals. So how many pieces do we divide the world into? Okay, you guys, let's look at a map here. Alexander's gone. We're going to divide up the world here. And Ptolemy says, I'm going to take Egypt. So Ptolemy takes Egypt. And that's how we end up with Greek-speaking rulers ruling in Egypt as pharaohs. And that's how we end up with Cleopatra, the seventh Ptolemy, and the last of the Greek Ptolemies, a Greek-speaking pharaoh. What do you call a woman pharaoh? Pharaohs? I'm not sure. We end up with her as the last. Okay. Oh, good. Well, I'm almost done, and we're going to make it. Yes. Thank you, Lord. So we translate everything that's worth anything into Greek. And guess what that includes? The ancient world had no access to those Hebrew scriptures. Have you seen Hebrew? I took 2 years of Hebrew. Now, I'm not the smartest kid on the block. That's true. But I took 2 years of Hebrew. And I got straight A's, and I can't read Hebrew hardly at all. I translated the book of Ruth, and I can still barely read mother-in-law, mother-in-law, mother-in-law. But Hebrew's really hard. You know, if the sun shines too hard, you move the vowels over one. If it's Wednesday, you move them over one this way. The accent changes. A lot of Hebrew people think it's pretty smart to just leave all the vowels out. You can recognize the word by just the consonants, right? With no divisions between the words? Yeah, okay. So we had to get the Old Testament into something other than Hebrew. And that is when we ended up with our Septuagint. Sometime in that period, after 300 and before about 250 BC, sometime in that time period, the Old Testament is translated into Greek. The tradition says in 70 days by 70 Hebrew scholars, and yes, it was Hebrew scholars who translated into Greek, Hebrew scholars who spoke Greek. That's very important to us today because that was written several hundred years before the time of Christ. And the New Testament will make use of the Septuagint and the word choices that those Hebrew scholars used 250 to 275 years, 250 to 275 years before Jesus was born, the word choices they will make are very, very important because Jesus will use some of those. In the Septuagint, the LXX for 70, in Exodus, Moses goes before Pharaoh and says, well, God, who am I going to tell him has sent me? I don't even know your name. Who am I going to say sent me? And what does God say? I am. You tell him, I am sent you. And in the Greek, it's ego eimi. I am. In the New Testament, where is it?
John 14:6.
Yes! Oh, that's Hannah. John 14:6. When Jesus says, I am, I'm the light. When he says, I am anything, I'm the truth, when he says, I'm the way, he's saying, ego eimi. In English, we should say, I am the way, exclamation point. But we don't have a way to say that in English, I am. In the Hebrew, you would say it three times, holy, holy, holy. If you're Isaiah and you have a vision and you want to describe the presence of God overflowing the temple in this vision, the year that King Uzziah died, I think, in Isaiah 6. But the Greeks would say, I am. When Jesus says, I am the truth, he's saying, I am, ego eimi, the truth. And that's why they, oh my goodness, we got it. This is blasphemous. We can't stand this. Because Jesus is there claiming God's name. That's one of the other cool things I learned. In seminary. I learned a few things in seminary. Okay. So now we're to the end of the Hellenistic age, but it's time for another culture to take over. Those four generals, can they hold the world together forever? No, they hate each other's guts. Ptolemy's always having to look at his back. You know, they're always trying to get more land. Each of them really wants to rule the entire world. They're always battling each other and trying to kill each other off, and the rest of the world doesn't really like being ruled by Greeks. And to be quite honest, God doesn't need them anymore. They've served their purpose. And now that we're approaching the birth of Christ, We've got the language set in place. Now what has to be done? Do you want the apostles traveling over dirt, over hill, and over dale, trying to go 30 miles to each town and village to share the gospel? No, wouldn't it be better to have some good roads built? So we're going to bring in the great architects. The Romans, who apparently had very little creativity, they looked at everything the Greeks did and said, "That looks good to me." And they copied everything the Greeks did, which is kind of nice because in many instances, the first century or first century BC, Roman copies of vases or statues are the only copies we have. We don't have the Greek originals from 500 and 600 BC, from earlier. So we're kind of thankful that they were copycats. But the Romans, they were just good engineers, weren't they? They could build aqueducts. They knew all about the arch. With that arch, they could build the Colosseum. They could do the aqueducts. They could do those huge baths. We don't want dirty Romans, do we? So what do you have to have a huge building with a public bath so that we can all take our baths together and hang out and talk politics while the slaves are down below huffing and puffing, running the furnace so that the floors will be warm for us? You've got to have huge arches, a huge vault to hold that up. And we're very thankful for the Romans. The apostles would need those roads. They would need all of those connections. We even had legions set at certain distances along all those roads, right? You could travel safely. Those first few years, that first century of the apostles, except the years when they had insane maniacal emperors who were butchering people. Every now and then you had an emperor who kind of ignored you for a while. And the apostles were able to go over these roads, to travel safely, to be protected, and to use Greek. Isn't that incredible? And so that's the end of Greece. That was a crash course in Greek history. And I'm going to give myself 14 minutes and stay on schedule. And at 10:30, we'll do our crash course in Roman history. Okay, take a break. Get up and move around.